Well, this morning's message is kind of does two things. One, it hopefully kind of wraps up the summer series on superheroes of the Bible, as we'll be looking at the character Daniel. And it also kind of looks ahead. We're going to be doing, starting next week, a series on Amos. And if you know anything about Amos, Amos was a person with a passion for seeing God's will done in the marketplace. He was a former agribusinessman, actually, who God called for a time to be a prophet. And so he understood very well what it was like, what were the challenges that one faced in the workplace. And I encourage you to take out, if you have the insert this morning, on the one side it has some opportunity to fill in some sermon notes there along the way, mixing faith and work. And also on the other side, some resources. And I'll be trying to flag those as it goes along. There's a number of them I've kind of worked into the message this morning. So a few samples, including a video clip from the first one that I kind of want to introduce this topic of work. You know, for most of us, work is the main thing that we spend our lives doing. Some people sleep as much as they work. Some of us don't sleep as much as we work anymore. And so what is work, and why is it such an important topic? Let's watch the first introduction to this morning.
What is work? What is this thing to which we devote most of our waking hours in the prime of our lives? Is it a curse? A punishment? A burden? A responsibility? Why do we work? What is the purpose? To put food on the table. To support our families. To get out of the house. To get rich. To be challenged. To build. To accomplish. To prove oneself. To show the doubters. To achieve, to succeed, to invent, to create, to compete, to conquer, to build wealth, to search for meaning, to leave a legacy, to find identity. But what if there's more? What if we are divinely placed wherever we are? What if it's about what we can give, not just what we get? What if work is an opportunity to worship our Creator and bring Him glory? Not just by the words we say, not just by the quality of our character, but by the excellence of our work. What is work? Work is worship.
That's a clip from one of our resources called On Right Now Media, which is a resource that is free to all of us as a congregation. We pay a set fee, and then as many of us as want to use that. It's kind of like Netflix for Christians in terms of a number of Christian resources. Do you believe that it is possible not to worship work, but to work as worship? Yes? Iffy? Well, we believe that it is possible to have our work as a means of serving and glorifying God every day. You know, many people see faith and work kind of like oil and water. You know, they never really mix. Some see it like, well, frosting maybe on a cake. You know, it's, I let people know I'm a Christian because I have a fish on the bumper of my car or on my business card, something. Or maybe it could be like yeast in bread, that our faith could permeate the dough and transform the whole thing. You know, I think it's one of the exciting things that I find in the Bible is that God gives us working models. And one of the working models we want to look at this morning of of how do we mix faith and work in healthy and holistic ways. And I want to look at the life of Daniel, and I encourage you to turn to the book of Daniel. And there were things that they neither had the responsibility or authority to even try to change. You know, the curriculum, they're teaching that. And yet there were other things in their circle of influence that they actually could not in good conscience adopt or embrace without at least trying to resist and to change. And the defiling aspects of the meal plan was one of them that we would see in chapter 1. And if we were to read that chapter, we would see Daniel and his friends' courage and wisdom combined with God, it says in verse 9, causing an official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. And it was a great lesson for them there as they stepped out and they said, man, do we really have to do this? Can we not put us to a test for 10 days and see if we eat a different diet and whether we're just not still as healthy and strong? And what they found was a great lesson that God showed up there. And God didn't want them to privatize or separate their faith from all the business of life. Their faith and their work, even in that place of education, needed to mix, even as students at UBC, or rather especially as students at UBC and other places need to do today. It's interesting, I was watching a bit of a documentary on Doc Zone. That's one of Elaine's favorite shows, and I watch it once in a while. And there was one called Faking the Grade, it was called. And just a brief excerpt from that. It said, it is estimated that at least 70% of university students cheated at some point during their high school years. Many continue to do it, and few get caught. Once they move into post-secondary education, research shows that those who cheat in school go on to cheat in life. I mean, watching, it was amazing how many complex ways. They had ways of cheating that I never even imagined were possible when I went to school. And then they concluded by saying, those cheaters are everywhere because ours is a culture where honesty has been devalued and a win-at-any-cost strategy is encouraged. You know, it's important to have working models of faith and work in school and university, both not only among students but also among faculty members. Often it's encouragement to a student to know that professor is a Christian because I'm trying to figure out how do I integrate faith and science. How do you deal with these intellectual questions or objections or challenges that arrive? And how do you, like, do you privatize or how do you kind of be open about your faith and survive that? Well, when Daniel and his friends entered the workforce, you know, they graduated at the head of their class, and then they entered the workforce, some of their colleagues and bosses came to value not only the quality of the work that they did, but also the honesty and integrity that grew out of the soil of their faith. But it is clear that not all of their bosses and work colleagues appreciated seeing Daniel and his friends getting top positions in the government, as we see that in chapter 6. For a time during the reign of King Belshazzar, I know it sounds a lot like Daniel's name, it's just missing that T. Belshazzar, the book of Daniel begins with Nebuchadnezzar, one of the great kings in Babylon, and then his son Nabonius takes over, but he mainly did a lot of traveling, we know from extra-biblical literature, so he doesn't even get mentioned, and his son is basically takes over for him while dad is doing lots of traveling for many years. And so Belshazzar is kind of Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, is now the king as we come to chapter 6. And it's interesting that at this point in the story, Daniel, we find him demoted or even dismissed from the position that he had. And wonder, well, how do we know that? Well, in chapter 5, when Belshazzar needed a wise man, there's a story there about suddenly he's having a big, huge party, celebrating his gods that he think are the gods of success. And suddenly a hand appears and writes on the wall. It's where we get our saying that's even common in our day. There's right, you know, did you read the writing on the wall? Well, it's a sign from God. And that's saying, you know, you've been weighed in the balance and found wanting. But he couldn't read that. He couldn't interpret what it was, the significance. And so Belshazzar gets all of his royal wise men to come in and to read the writing on the wall. Tell him what it says and what it means. And you know what it says in chapter 5, verse 8? How many of the king's wise men came in? Look at chapter 5, verse 8. All of them come in. You know, but he knows Daniel is noticeably absent. You know, in the queen mother, in verse 11, when none of these guys can do it, she'll say, well, you know, you really should have been asking the guy who was prominent in your, you know, in the previous era there. And so what we find out is the person that who had been the CEO, if you will, of the wisdom of the wise men department under the reign of Belshazzar's grandfather, under Nebuchadnezzar, you know, he must have been dismissed and told to move his stuff out of the office. That must have been frustrating, humiliating. He would have been working probably, we estimate, for at least 40 years, close to 40 years in that position. Probably somewhere in his late 50s. Time for early retirement. You're no longer needed. I wonder what a faith and being fired mix looks like. You know, we don't know exactly, but that is always an opportunity, isn't it? An opportunity to trust God to provide in ways maybe that we, you know, we got used to the paycheck being the means that God providing. It also, we know it can often be a test of whether we've been trying to get more out of our work than God intends it to give. You know, we do that. God wants us to have a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment in our work, but often we try to make it part of our identity. That's who I am and my significance. There's a clip I want to show you from a resource that is also on your list, number 5. Timothy Keller talk called Work, What Is It Good For? And in there, there's a lady who's going to be telling a story. She kind of runs a whole department in their church, helping people connect faith and work. And she shares the story about Aaron Callan, an article, Is There Life After Work? And she'll explain in there, Aaron Callan was the chief financial officer of Lehman Brothers, who tanked a couple of years ago. Here's the clip.
Bring in the Aaron Callan last week, the former CFO of Lehman, basically resigned, was forced to resign right a month before the collapse of Lehman. And she writes, I'll just read a quote or two. Since I resigned my position as CFO of Lehman in 2008 amid the chaos and cloud of public humiliation, I've had ample time to reflect on the decisions I made in balancing, or rather failing to balance, my job with the rest of my life. I didn't start out with the goal of devoting all myself to my job. My boundaries just slipped away until work was all that was left. Inevitably, when I left my job, it devastated me. What I did was who I was. Without this crisis, I would have never been strong enough to step away.
My work became who I was, she said. We don't know what happened to Daniel, but we know that at that stage in life, he was obviously dismissed, sidelined. Probably, this is 15 years later. What did he do during that time? We only know how he shows up, and we know that he is a person still actively mixing faith and work. In his long career, Daniel knew what it was like to face numerous moral and ethical dilemmas, as a number of the earlier stories give us. And he knew what it was like to be unceremoniously dismissed from a job, forced into early retirement. In chapter 6, we also discover that he experienced backstabbing colleagues who resented one of the exiles from Judah, as they will call him in verse 13, being put into one of the top government posts instead of them. I want to read part of the chapter, Daniel chapter 6, beginning of verse 1. Just so you know, just in the end of chapter 5, Belshazzar, the guy who had the writing on the wall, that was the end of the line for him. And we even know from other ancient Near Eastern documents as well that the Medes took over. Cyrus, also known as Darius, which is probably his throne name, takes over. And so we see now Darius is on the throne in chapter 6. And it pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps, that is, leaders, to rule throughout the kingdom. with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. That is, he might not lose territory or taxes. You know, somebody might not be paying their taxes. Now, Daniel, it says, so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel and his conduct of government affairs. Probably like a Senate review committee. But they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him, not in his expense account or whatever, because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever." The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, governors, in other words, all of us have agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." So Darius, probably we might add, feeling very good about himself, put the decree in writing. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed. That is, this was his habit, longly ingrained. These were the sacred rhythms of his life. And he prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except to you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said, "Remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order. They brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, may he rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. The first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "May the king live forever. My God sent his angel and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." And the king was overjoyed, and he gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, "May you prosper greatly. I issued a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. This was the greatest, the largest empire in existence to that time. And Daniel was placed over it. I want to explore briefly this morning Daniel's faith-work mix. We've already seen some, but explore it. What do people notice about him? Do you think they looked and they said, "Oh, that it's like oil and water. Never mix. Oh, it's just a frosting. It's just kind of, but everywhere, you know, he's basically does, he's the same as everybody else, but he's got the frosting." Or is it, no, it's like permeates everything he does. Well, you know, first thing that we notice is, well, at least the first thing I think that Darius noticed as the new leader is that despite a change of government, Daniel continued to enjoy his favor. He noticed that this guy did quality work. I mean, why else do you think that he would take over and he would look to the previous and say, you know, who is there that's got a good track record that I could maybe pull into this new government? You know, when we, in chapter 5, in the explicitly on the lips of the queen was the quality of Daniel and the integrity of him. And he does quality work. He did it as a student. He did it when he was a lower employee, with, if you will. And he did it when he was the leader himself. In his book, Ministry and Daily Life, William Deal describes the quality of the of our work. He describes that as the our ministry of competence. He says that's the primary ingredient of our faith witness in the workplace. There's a company years ago had the motto, right? Quality is job one. Quality is job one. Now, it doesn't mean, you know, we can't all be the best. And we can't always be error-free, right? People make what we ourselves call honest mistakes. But we can try to consistently do the best we can with the time and resources and abilities that we are given, right? As a Christian, we shouldn't be aiming for, oh, it's good enough. Good enough. You know, I was challenged years ago talking to my brother-in-law, who's a plumber for many years and gas fitter and did mainly repairs. He said, you know, when I was apprenticing with my boss, he said, you know, one of the things he taught me, he said, you know, painters, when they do a work of art, they sign their name on the bottom corner. He says, and when we are plumbers, when we do our work, you know, we have a signature too. You look at these different soldering joints, they have different soldering joints. And he said, which one would you want to have your name signed to? You can see the quality if you know that in that area or field. I know they're moving to PECs and different kinds, but soldering joints. And he said, you know, it taught me the importance of the quality. Would I be willing to sign my name on this so the next guy that comes along sees that? And maybe we could ask in different fields. Maybe you're a cook or a baker. Would you be willing to eat or cook what you baked? Would you be willing to buy what you are making for the price that you are selling it? I think that's a good question. You know, I sometimes wonder if my kids would be benefit from this next one. Have you left the room in the condition that you wanted to find it when you came in? Or the bathroom, you know, whatever it is. Just some litmus tests. You know, and if not, then you need to be mixing more faith into your work. Well, a second thing that we notice with Daniel, it says itself that he was noted for his exceptional qualities. Exceptional, it has the idea of you know, well, it's outstanding, it's surpassing, it's preeminent. And the qualities, it's actually the word ruach, which means spirit. And it could be that it's the sense of, he's got like this character, the quality of the gods. He's got like the spirit of the gods. He's that outstanding. And we see right away, I mean, how it might be defined right away in the next verse. No corruption, trustworthy, and neither corrupt nor negligent. He's reliable. He's consistent. He's got integrity with his mention, you know, with his Senate expense account. We also would know back, he's reasonable in the midst of a situation of great conflict back in chapter 2. Daniel, when the king is flying off on the handle, and he's wanting to do away with all of his wise men because they're not able to do what he wants. It says that Daniel, he spoke with wisdom and with tact in the midst of that situation. You're reminded of a story of a relatively new employee, been on the job probably for a month or two. And he answered the phone in the office. And the caller wanted to talk with the boss. And the boss happened to be around. And so he's putting the phone down and he's saying, "It's for you. It's such and such." And the boss says, "Tell him I'm not in." And he paused for a moment and then he handed him the phone and said, "Here, you tell him." Well, the boss did eventually get off that phone call. And he was, let's say, quite irate at his employee for what he had done. "How could you do this?" And his employee said to him, he said, "If I can lie for you, I can lie against you. And I'm not willing to do either." You know, and it's not really a surprise that within a number of years, he became his most trusted employee as he worked his way up into an area of a scope of work in that workplace. That's integrity. That's character. You know, exceptional spirit, as we said here, exceptional qualities, exceptional spirit, can also mean that he was recognized as a person who is very spiritual, a person with spiritual integrity. So not only quality work, and not only exceptional character, but spiritual integrity. And we see as the story shifts from the court to Daniel's home, he hears about the king's new law forbidding prayer to anyone but the king himself. And Daniel's response, you know, in some sense, it's very simple. He continues with business as usual. He goes upstairs where the window is open towards Jerusalem because that was the city where he had been brought from. And part of his prayer would have been, "God, restore us someday to that place." Daniel clearly had spiritual integrity. His regular habit was to pray, it says, to the Lord 3 times a day. Evening, probably. Noon. Evening, morning, and noon in Hebrew fashion. It was mixed in. That was a part of. And so it says, yes, he was thanking God, and he was also asking, they heard him asking God for help. You know, he's not flaunting his rebellion in the face of the king's orders. He's not hiding it. He is praying in an upper room with the windows open, probably because it's Babylon, it's hot. He is not on public display, but neither is he being secretive or extra cautious, lest what he'd be doing be discovered by somebody, you know, spying on him. And you know, we know there were determined spies who can't wait to report Daniel to the king. I'm reminded of a story, remember, a fellow who was going to work in, how we call it, a lumber camp up north, northern BC. And one of his friends knew enough to know that is a hostile setting for faith. It's a pretty rough crowd that goes there. And so when his friend got back from his summer from there, he said, "You know, I wondered, how did it go when they found out you were a Christian?" And his friend said, "Oh, there wasn't a problem at all. They never found out." Wow. How could they never find out, eh? Daniel's life is distinguished not only by the negative things which he will not commit, it says no corruption, but by a positive duty which he will not omit, even when the wind of public opinion and law suddenly changes direction. You know, when we need this kind of courage and integrity and living faith greater than ever. In the closing section of the chapter, we see that the superhero of the story, Daniel, is a great man. But the real superhero is God with his miraculous deliverance of the elderly Daniel from the lion's den. You know, Daniel was by this time what we would call a senior citizen. He was probably well into his 70s, maybe even 80 years old, because the chapters, first six chapters, cover a period of approximately 60 years. And in these stories of Jewish captives living and working under successive pagan rulers and regimes, we are given illustrations not only of the challenges, but the opportunities of living faith. And Daniel's consistent, the quality of his work, the exceptional character, the consistency, integrity, and the spiritual integrity, they set him apart, him and his friends, from their contemporaries. And they positively influenced even pagan kings towards faith in the living God. You know, might also ask, are there times and places where we shouldn't mix faith and work? It was interesting, in last month's elders meeting, somehow we got into this discussion for a little time. And we got into a discussion of, actually, there are times when work and church shouldn't mix. And two illustrations. One, our elder Brian, who works as a realtor. And he said, you know, one of the guys in the office once said, man, you must have it set with all those clients in your church. You know, it's like, what a corner on the market. And Brian said, that's not what I use my place at church for. You know, I don't mix those things. I don't use that as an opportunity, you know, to advance my business. And Juan also works in fixing cars. And Juan said, you know, I don't want, when I come on Sunday mornings, I don't want to talk business. I want to just leave. I want to actually rest from my work and just focus on God and being here with God's people. And so, you know, but sometimes people want to bring up business and, you know, and how about the appointment or what should I do with this? He says, I ask them, save that for Monday. So it's times not to mix. But often we should be mixing our faith and our work together in positive ways. And I want to close with a challenge by, let's see, I've got two options. I'm going to show this video clip from Making Mondays Meaningful. It's a six-week, from a free six-week study I've got in the resource list on there. And within that, it's got a number of clips from business people on different topics. And here's one by Albert Black. And I thought it's interesting, well, I think you'll know why, how he has been working at applying faith in his work. If you can click it for me, please.
Now, if he agreeing with you that he's being satisfied, or we still having that situation?
I think what happens is people would rather see a sermon than hear one any day. They'd rather that I walk with them than just show them the way. But I think small business people cannot become the cookie-cutter mold that oftentimes our corporate partners are. What we have to be is leaders that take risks, that we actually go out there and make a difference in people's lives. It's a matter of going in and making sure that the people that have trust you with their career are getting the fair return for that trust that they put in you. You see, nothing works like work. This is not welfare. This is work. There are some rules and conditions that we all have to go by. I think that what you have to do is be patient in the education piece of it by continuously informing and making people aware of what ramifications you being late have on the enterprise.
Right.
And once people understand the dire condition that you can put an organization in if they're late, if they're still late, well, then that means that they don't care.
So how do we get them to care?
You probably don't, Hattie. At some point, you have got to disengage and remove yourself from that relationship.
Okay.
It really is a situation called tough love. And whereas it sounds a lot more favorable for those of us in business to say that you continue to work with people, but at On Target Supplies and Logistics, we have something called a progressive discipline program. The first time a person is late, we sit down and talk with them, and we let them know the ramifications of being late and how what type of impact it has on coworkers and the enterprise. Because everybody that's hired has a very important role to play in the enterprise. The second time, we actually write it up and put it in your personnel file. The third time, we'll suspend you for a couple of days. If the four times it happened and you're still late, we terminate your employment and we figure out that one didn't work.
Okay, so it's okay to let someone go if they know the rules and they break the rules.
It's okay. Matter of fact, it goes beyond being okay. I really do encourage it. You see, the reality of responsibility has to be, it has to be demonstrated throughout the relationship between employee and employer. Just because an organization has a big heart doesn't mean that it has a small mind. It has to keep its eye on the bottom line. And when people are late, it's bad for the culture. It's because if it's permitted too much, what'll end up taking place is the culture becomes that of being late. At On Target Supplies and Logistics, we think that we're in the distribution business. We deliver on time. And if you're late at work, how can we possibly deliver to our customers on time?
Who's going to be on time Monday morning? Yay, there we go. Thank you. I encourage you to think about what do I need to mix into my work this coming week?